Hey everyone, it's Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 130th podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. That is, as always, John Rauhaus playing the pedal steel in the background, and today we are talking to singer, songwriter, producer Paul Birch. Paul actually wrote for the Fretboard Journal way, way back. If you've been a longtime subscriber, you may remember the story we did with Dwayne Eddy. Paul wrote that. But he's been lately working on this very cool project called Meridian Rising. We actually featured it recently in the magazine and posted it on our website. And Meridian Rising is sort of a musical autobiography of the life of Jimmy Rogers. And a project like that can go either way, but I thought in Paul's hands, he did a tremendous job. It is actually great music that holds up whether or not you care about Jimmy Rogers. And it's just a fun listen. I wanted to hear a little bit more about that, as well as get a little bit of a sense of Paul's background, because I really didn't know what he was up to before he got to Nashville. So he fills us in on all of that, talks about the countless hours he spent at Tootsie's being a bar band member, and a lot more. It's a fun chat. I want to thank everybody, before we get to that, for all the great feedback they've been giving us over our weekly podcast series. I know a bunch of you have been subscribing via iTunes, which is awesome. And a lot of you wrote in about the vintage Gibson guitar panel that we just posted last week. We will keep those panels coming. I think there are two or three more from the Fretboard Summit that we can share with you. So you will be looking forward to those in early 2017, I suppose. Our latest issue, Fretboard Journal 37, is, of course, out with Nels Klein on the cover. You can still get that from us. We still have some copies here. And issue 38 is about to go to press, and that'll be out in mid-January. So this is a perfect time to subscribe to the journal if you haven't yet at fretboardjournal.com. Before we talk to Paul, I do want to give a shout out to our friends at TR Crandall. They are sponsoring this podcast. That's TRCRANDALL.com over in New York. Those guys are so awesome, and thinking about Jimmy Rogers and that Wyman guitar that he played, I did what I often do when I go to a vintage guitar website, and I clicked on the other tab. Sometimes I don't want to start with all the Fenders and Martins and Gibsons and all the usual stuff. I like to see what a store has in the other category. Right now, they've got a 1970s Harptone E6NC, a very cool, weird, rare guitar. Not a lot's known about those. I think there's some sort of Standell connection, and obviously George Harrison played a Harptone. They were built in New Jersey. They've got one of those for sale. They also have a Bacon and Day Senorita for sale right now. It's not a blinged out one like John Fahey played, but it is beautiful, and I bet it sounds fantastic. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't say T.R. Crandall also has a ton of Fenders, Martins, and Gibsons. All the good stuff. So go to TRCRANDALL.com. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. They also do exceptional repair work if any of you guys are near New York and need someone to work on your guitar. All right, I'm done rambling. Here is our conversation with Paul Birch. I hope you enjoy it, and Happy New Year, everybody. We will see you in 2017. So, Paul, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast. I know you've contributed to our magazine. You did that great article on Dwayne Eddy. I just wrote about you and your Jimmy Rogers project. But what I don't know about you is, you know, I remember in the mid or late 90s, whenever anybody would write a record review about you, it would say Paul Birch, and then in parentheses, formerly of Lamb Chop. But I know nothing pre-Lamb Chop or even how you got yourself to Nashville. Are you from Nashville?
No, I was born in Washington, D.C.,
okay,
and spent my childhood around there, and then spent a little time in Mississippi, but mostly spent my teenage years in Indiana, about an hour north of Indianapolis and about 3 hours south of Chicago in a town called West Lafayette.
And your music is so rooted in Americana and the South and the glory days of country music. Were you exposed to that music early on?
Well, I was, I think, like most kids growing up in the 70s, I heard everything. Washington, D.C. was a really great place to grow up for music. There was a lot of bluegrass. There was a great radio station there called WHFS. And WHFS played a very eclectic They were not an album rock station. They were more like whatever freeform stations are out now. They were more like a college station. But, I mean, they would play Little Richard, and then they'd play something by Squeeze, and then they'd play something by Jules Holland, and then they'd play Embryonic Journey by Jefferson Airplane, and then they'd play the Sonics. And, you know, it was a musical education for sure. And, I mean, although it's funny, I get called country a lot. I think of myself more as a rock and roll singer who just happened to have a little more country leaning. But again, when I first started listening to music, rock and roll was pretty country. I mean, in 1970, when I was 4 years old, James Taylor's Sweet Baby James, that's a very country record.
Sure.
And the band was very country, and Bob Dylan was very country. Guitar fans out there, if you sit down and you play John Lennon's solo on Get Back, it's pretty much a pedal steel sounding kind of a solo, you know, I think anyway. So it just was kind of, and John Prine's first record I really, really loved when I was a kid. That was a very important record for me. I just got a lot of joy out of that. So I just heard that was kind of in the air, you know, a lot of clean sounds, not very smeary sounds. You know, the 70s tended to be very, on one hand, very kind of muffly sounding records, but also a lot of very clean picking. Lindsey Buckingham on all the Fleetwood Mac records, he's a very clean picker. So I think that's, you know, I was originally a drummer, but when I started performing, a lot of the singers in my range whose voices were pitched in the same range as mine tended to be people like the Everly Brothers or you know, black artists like Arthur Alexander or John Lee Hooker, who had, you know, say a different range than Howlin' Wolf or Muddy Waters, you know. So whatever I could kind of imitate and sing, that's whatever felt comfortable to me, that's kind of what I ended up playing. But It's. I remember the first time I played guitar, someone said, "I didn't realize you'd be so country." I was like, "What, really?" But that's you know, it's okay. It's you can't fight City Hall, I guess.
Yeah. And when did you take up guitar?
I took up guitar when I was probably I think when I was 21. I went as Bob Dylan for Halloween, and I learned Motopsycho Nightmare. Which is just three chords. And I thought, well, this is pretty easy. So I was very intimidated to play guitar for a long time. And I was pretty horrible at it for about 10 years. And then I started to gradually get better. And I feel like I've actually gotten better at it just in the last few years. But there's a long, for some players, maybe a lot of players, you know, there's a kind of a no man's land where it's, unless you're around really good players, it's really hard to know how to get better, you know, especially in the era before YouTube, where you could, you know, focus on a particular song and learn a bunch of skills. I think when I moved to Nashville and heard the variety of talent around me and just the many different ways to play. One of the first guitar players I heard every day was Kenny Vaughan, who I don't know if you know Kenny,
of course.
But Kenny's an extraordinary session player, everything player. Well, when I was playing on Lower Broadway, he was the lead guitar player in a band that a singer named Greg Gehring shared. And Kenny is like a combination of, you know, Speedy West and Charlie Christian and, you know, but he's totally, I mean, he's, as everyone knows and loves him for it, he's totally original, but he just had this fluidity and a sense of melody. Whatever melody you played, he's going to play it back to you. And I had never played with someone with that capability. You know, I have great warmth and affection for every person along the way who's taught me a lot, you know, but I never knew anyone like Kenny, and there's only one Kenny, really. But he was like all those guys wrapped up into one. Anybody I'd admired, whether it was, you know, Barney Kessel or Charlie Christian or T-Bone Walker, and, you know, he just had it. And I'd never met anyone who, you'd say, well, we need an introduction for this. And he'd play a bit of the melody, and you'd have an introduction. And And even today, it's hard, you know, not every guitar player thinks along those lines, you know, thinks in terms of, like, what is being said and all that kind of stuff. So even though I couldn't, I still can't play like him, nobody can, but he's in my head a lot, you know, when it comes to just tone and he had, you know, quite a handful of his own individual ferocious rockabilly licks. You know, anyone who's heard him in action, he's a force to be reckoned with for sure.
So did you move to Nashville to be a drummer?
No, I had, by the time I moved to Nashville, I guess I had been playing guitar for about 7 or 8 years, and I wanted to be, you know, I've been writing songs for a long time, and I always wanted to be a singer and write songs, or I always wanted to make records, really, I think, is what my main goal was, and I had no idea what that meant other than that I grew up in an era like when albums were really important. It was like the great American novel, so I wanted to do that, too, and I had already been writing songs and been playing guitar for a little bit, and I had a bunch of friends from Indiana who had moved here, including a fellow I went to high school with named Jay McDowell, who eventually played bass with BR549. But he was here, and we had another mutual friend who was playing organ in Lamb Chop, and they were very sweet. They just called me and said, you know, there's a, you know, you should come down here. There's something that's going to happen, but they didn't know what. And I think they got the sense that there were a lot of, you know, we were all in our late 20s, and most everybody else was a lot older. And so there wasn't, you know, there was not much of a rock scene, virtually no independent scene. But we had all grown up with the admiration of independent records and stuff. So I think they rightly figured out that there was something that was going to happen, which is eventually became kind of the Lower Broadway and Americana, so to speak. But there was, you know, a kind of a growing interest in, or just a feeling that there were a lot of people like them, my friends, I mean, who were very different than the typical Nashville music story. And so they, you know, said, you need to come down here. And like a lot of people who moved to Nashville, when I moved there, you know, I shared an apartment with like 12 other people, a two-bedroom apartment with 12 people. I had the couch. I had to wait till everybody went to sleep. But, you know, we lived out by the airport and played as much as we could. And my the advantage I had was that I had been in, played drums in bands and sang and played guitar on my own. And so I had a lot of performance time under my feet, whereas there were a lot of, at the time in the clubs, this is when Garth Brooks and Shania Twain were very big, and you were either a singer or you were a writer or you were a producer. You weren't trying to be all three. So at first it was kind of hard to find a place to play, and that's kind of what put me down in the honky-tonks, because there you had a four-hour slot, and you just had to fill it, which meant staying on your feet for 4 hours, which I was kind of used to, because I used to play house parties and stuff. So that was kind of the only place I could play and kind of just try to become a better singer and guitar player. And I was kind of already really keen to even take a break from songwriting and just get into a lot of early country music, because that was something that was not very available, really, until I moved to Nashville. I had primarily listened to, you know, a lot of R&B before that. But you know, there were a lot of record stores in Nashville that had 78s and 45s and stuff. And so a lot of country music I loved was out of print in anywhere else in the country, but you could find it in Nashville. Like, there was no Louvin Brothers compilations. Mm-hmm. There was no, a lot of Merle Haggard was out of print, and you know, Hank Williams was in print, and a lot of Johnny Cash, but lots of artists that I kind of discovered, you know, singles by Red Foley and Floyd Tillman and early George Jones. You know, that stuff was just not, you could get it on Bear Family, but, you know, I didn't have 2 cents to rub together.
You had 11 roommates, yeah.
Right, I had 11 roommates, right, so I couldn't really buy a box set. So it was cool, you know. Nashville was not very built up, and you could get anywhere in 10 minutes, and is a really, it was a pretty tight community.
Were those honky-tonks welcoming of the guys from Indiana who wanted to, you know, play kind of off the beaten path music?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think so. I mean, we kind of fell into it, and once we got there, we developed a kind of, you know, a kind of parameters, so to speak. Like, I can't speak for BR-549, but they were drawing from kind of country western and rockabilly stuff because they had drums. And in the group that I shared with Greg, we didn't have drums. So, for instance, when I was playing at Tootsie's, we thought, okay, we're going to go post-war, pre-Elvis. So that's like 1946 to early Sun, and or like pre-Elvis, you know. So I tended to, when I did covers, I tended to, because I'm such a blues fan, I tended to go for like the bluesier things. I was not, say, a big George Morgan fan, but I was a fan of George Jones and Lefty Frizzell and Ernest Tubb, who's a big Jimmy Rogers fan. And so I also was trying to find things that I could sing, you know. I mean, some country singers have Lefty is a beautiful singer, but unless that style comes really easily to you, you know, it's an impossible thing to imitate. So, you know, but I was kind of naturally inclined to want to sing like that, but I couldn't really sing like Lefty. So I would try to find singers who had a unique writing style. You know, I tended to cover people like Floyd Tillman, who wrote his own songs, because I could kind of relate to that, or early Willie Nelson things. And but you know, we tended to do, you know, we really didn't go into like late 50s stuff. Like we were also very, as you are in youth, kind of snobbish about it. Like, you know, well, after, you know, 57, 58, country music died, which isn't really true. It probably died by 1961. But, you know, it's not really, but I have a much broader perspective of it now. But, you know, for us, the hardcore fans, we were like, man, Ray Price, Hank Williams, Will Smith, Webb Pierce, that's the stuff, you know, and everything after kind of was not really what we wanted to do. So, I mean, it's, you know, we weren't that like high-minded about it, but it was music you couldn't find anywhere else, and so it seemed very fresh. I mean, to me as a writer, it was super exciting because I was hearing something. I liken it to, you know, so country music is so dismissed even today, even though it's kind of back. I was talking to Margot Price recently, and she said, you know, I don't want to take her own words, but something to the effect of like, you know, we'll never play your records. And she's like, well, somebody is, you know.
Yeah.
But to me, it was like meeting an uncle or member of your family that everybody told you should stay away from. If you just listen, I mean, if you didn't get into country music, you're really not learning rock and roll. Because all the clarity, for instance, that you hear in, say, someone like Jimmy Page, that comes straight out of Les Paul and country music, you know. More so, I mean, like the blues and R&B is in there, but there's more country picking and a lot of Led Zeppelin stuff than they would care to admit, you know. And so you can't, it's a marriage of the two, because rock and roll came from the South, and that's what people were listening to. They were listening to both. Just like Arthur Alexander was a huge Eddie Arnold fan, Scotty Moore was a huge Lowell Fulson fan.
Yeah.
So you can't really separate the two. You know, it might make a good article if you want to be kind of, you know, smarty pants about it. But it's, you know, and especially here in Nashville, you know, there's a huge R&B community here, and a lot of great R&B records were cut here. And if they weren't cut here, they were cut, you know, an hour and a half away.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in Muscle Shoals, or 2.5 hours away in Memphis. So it's not, you know, the musicians went back and forth. It's not this kind of cut and dried thing. So to me, it was like I was right in the middle of the, of it all. It was great.
And were these guys that you adored and who influenced you, some of them were still around. Did you ever run into them? Were there ever any meetings with these legends?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I looked up as many of them as I could. You know, there's some that I was just too in awe of, and I didn't have anything to say. But session musicians and songwriters I tended to look up as just to talk to them. And, you know, every once in a while you'd hear a funny story about, just not necessarily funny, but a story about them trying to pitch a song to someone, and that person took another song instead, and so I'd go out and find the song that they pitched, you know, because I remember there was one writer, and forgive me, I can't remember his name, but he wrote some songs. He wrote a song for Flat and Scruggs called On My Mind, which I quite like, which the Earls of Leicester redid recently. And he talked about writing songs for Marty Robbins and other, you know, and pitching this and pitching that. And so sometimes you discover a great title that wound up on a B-side that otherwise you'd never, never run across unless you had, like, the complete Marty Robbins or the complete Carl Smith. So that, as a songwriter, that was fun for me because having to be on stage for 3 hours at a time, I was always in search of material, right? Even though somehow, no matter how many songs you know, there's usually about 12 that you end up doing all over and over again.
Yeah.
I was kind of keen to find, like, something different that someone hadn't heard, either in case it gave me an idea or whether it just became a cool song. And in that way, I mean, I think if you talk to Jay McDowell, he'd say the same thing. You know, for a lot of us as big Beatle fans, it was like being in Hamburg, you know, searching for American R&B B-sides to do that the other bands didn't do. That was like the friendly competition between our group and BR549, is that we were always trying to, you know, meet people who made these records, or someone who played on a Bob Dylan record, or someone who played on a Hank Williams record, and just to hear stories or find out about, you know, in some cases you might find that someone co-wrote a song and didn't get credit. There was one of the very early songwriters in Nashville was a guy named Vic McAlpin, and Vic, like Arthur Alexander in R&B, didn't play an instrument, but he just sang. He sang melodies and he wrote words. And Vic is credited with writing Rocket in My Pocket that NRBQ wrote, and there's a great Eddie Arnold song that he wrote to, I think called Almost or Always. I can't remember the name of it. But and Vic was a fishing buddy of Hank Williams. And so Hank was always in need of songs. You know, there was enormous pressure on him to write more and more hits because he was, you know, he was spending money as fast as he could make it. But also there was, you know, once Hank broke, it was huge competition of people who were influenced by him, like Webb Pierce and Carl Smith. So, you know, Hank was always looking for titles that would inspire him to write or finish someone's song or buy, like, the skeleton of a song and finish it. And Vic was one of those guys who was around, and he, you know, so he had passed away, but I met his widow, who bought me a whole folder full of stuff and gave me a CD of demos that he had made for Acuff Rose, and so then I had like this pool of songs to listen to and consider, and so that was kind of like the great thing about Nashville, is that most of those guys who played on those records were still around. They were in their 70s, and they were glad that somebody cared, because, you know, modern country didn't care about those cats at all. I mean, they had just totally moved on. In the case of a lot of the musicians, were like that too. There was a great steel guitar player named Dwayne Birdwell, who was kind of a shadow guitar player for Jerry Bird. If Jerry Bird was double booked, he would send Dwayne Birdwell. And Dwayne was extraordinary steel player and, never went to pedal, played lap. And, you know, he, for various reasons, he never really, you know, quote unquote, made it. But he had all the ability of somebody who could make it. And so he kind of got my friend Paul Niehaus started, and Paul played in Lamb Chop, but he played with the band in Tootsies and eventually went on to play with Calexico and Justin Towns Earl and a whole bunch of people. Paul's great. And Paul had started off as a guitar player and learned steel guitar for Lamb Chop. And then when I pulled him into the Honky Tonk Band, he suddenly had to learn, you know, a specific kind of song structure that's typical of country music at the time and R&B at the time. So Dwayne was somebody who kind of gave him his bearings, you know, and taught him to play Room Full of Roses and some of the standards that have great kind of interesting steel slants and things like that, that would give him a whole bag of tricks. And so, you know, Dwayne was an example of somebody that outside of Nashville, nobody really knew who he was, but he was a great resource because he knew all of these stories and he could really, really play. And he, you know, and it was also very helpful to see that having a lot of talent in some cases really didn't matter, because the things that kept Dwayne from being successful, you know, could happen to anybody. So when you come into I don't know if it's still like this because the really, you know, the music industry is so crashed, but at the time the music industry was still really happening here, you know. They were still selling CDs and digital hadn't taken over, and so, you know, a lot of musicians came here to be an artist, or they came to be a producer, or they came to be a session musician. And, you know, none of our group sort of fit into those categories. We were kind of, you know, and a lot of the songwriters I ended up being friends with, like Phil Lee and Kevin Gordon, they were producing their own records pretty much because no one else wanted to. You know, they deserve to have their own producers, but I became a producer mostly because no one was interested in doing it. So I thought, well, if I'm paying for the studio and I'm paying for the pizza, I guess I'm producing. So you learn a lot by that, and you also get to observe. You know, when you're not in those clubs, you sort of get to see the people who make it tend to have a really positive attitude. They show up tuned up, ready to play, ready to contribute, and you know, they're loose. They really enjoy where they are at that moment. And you can always tell the kind of amateurs, because they come in talking about someone else's music in the session. Yeah, I played so-and-so with such-and-such, you know, and it's like they're not paying attention to where they are at that moment. Or they're playing a bunch of licks that they used, you know, they're playing licks because they can play them, but not because it's what the song calls for.
Yeah.
And so you get it's a real eye-opener, like what's A-level and B-level, you know? And you know, the B-level session players are, you know, they're capable, but they don't really do anything for you. You know, musically, you'd almost be better off just cutting the thing by yourself than to have a bunch of noise behind you that's not really musical, that's just by the numbers. And you can tell, I mean, with all the Americana stuff that's out now, some of it's like a gong show, you know. You can put any voice in front of it, it's the same thing over and over again. But then when you get somebody who's working with their actual band, it makes a big difference, because
yeah.
You can, or someone who has a kind of idea and specific things that they like, it makes a big difference, because it has its own kind of sound, you know. And I think every city has to deal with that, that has a music scene. I'm sure Chicago does, and New York and Los Angeles. And Nashville, you know, so many songwriters start off playing an acoustic guitar, you know, or wanting to rock. And so you really have to weave things carefully to make sure that you don't end up making a record that sounds like 50 other records coming out that month.
Yeah. I'm curious, you talked about all the work that you had put into your Tootsie sets and how long they were. Were you making money doing those? Does anybody make money doing those?
Oh, you're so sweet. No, no, we didn't make Tootsies. I don't know if they're still like this, but at the time they were under dual ownership. The two owners were fighting each other, and we just had a tip jar. And sometimes one of the owners, you know, just pulled a gun and said, the night's over. He took our entire tip jar and kicked everybody out of the joint because he had a forged document that said that the other owner had sold Tootsies to him, and then they went to court, and it was nuts. I mean, it was really like a honky tonk. You know, one night someone got thrown through a plate glass window, and it was rough, you know. It was, and I mean, now Lower Broadway is like, it's like Bourbon Street. It's just filled with people drinking and drinking. But my distinctive memory of playing down there was that after about 11 o'clock at night or 10 o'clock at night, it would be completely empty. And across the street from Tootsie's is the Ernest Tubb record store, and there's this revolving sign with Ernest Tubb's face, right?
Sure.
It's been there since the 50s, and you could hear the creak of the thing. It would echo through the street like it was, you know, the OK Corral. And man, it just was, it was full of peep shows and nasty bars, and it was not a place that people went to. So, I mean, they went to see us, inexplicably. I don't know why, but I guess we were just kind of the cause of the week, you know. But nowhere else was getting any business. And BR549 stayed there longer than we did, and they had a lot of advantages, you know, having drums and having a bigger place, and the owner was really. And they were great too. I'm not discounting that, but they had sort of everything they needed to make a lasting stand. Whereas, although Tootsie's makes a great story, playing there makes a great story, and I'm glad I have it. I was also really happy to get out of there because it was a bit treacherous.
Was there a specific moment where you like had enough and knew you were going to give your notice?
I can't even remember what it is. I think, I don't remember anything specific. At one point we left there, I think just because it was a drag, and we went to this makeshift coffee store that had opened a few doors down that had a big stage, and it was called Jitters. That was the name of the coffee place. But it wasn't, they didn't even have an espresso machine. They just had this Mr. Coffee machine. and the advantage they had was this great space. They had this huge upstairs loft space, and it was a, you know, just a couple, you know, primordial millennials who wanted to have a space to play. And so they had a stage, and we would go there and we get a pretty good crowd, but I don't think they could serve beer unless you just snuck it in on a six pack, and it didn't quite have the cachet of Tootsie's.
Yeah,
and
was this around when the WPA Ball Club formed, or what? Where are we at with the timeline of that?
Yeah, the WPA kind of formed while I was. While I was at Tootsie's, Paul Niehaus was kind of a charter member, and he gave me a very nice phone call. He said, look, I don't want to be in charge of a band or try to get a band together, but I will play in a band with you if you get a band together. And I said, that's very fair. So Paul was the first member, and then a wonderful bass player who I still play with and has helped me make a lot of my records, Dennis Crouch, had just moved to Arkansas. And Dennis eventually became T-Bone Burnett's studio bassist. But Dennis and I were just a really great match in playing. He's a very melodic bassist, and we had a lot of the same, you know, very democratic love of a lot of different kinds of music. So that kind of was the foundation of the group. And then about every year, you know, somebody else would materialize out of thin air, it seemed like, and kind of fit the bill. So I've called it the WPA Ball Club, you know, all of this time, but it took a few years to sort of build the foundational sound of what it was going to be.
Got it. And then when it took after that period of time, did sort of the tone of your shows change, and did they kind of mellow out from how they were at Tootsie's and kind of evolve?
They evolve, but I think they've become less mellow. You know, the first couple years, you know, the first few years I performed, I really enjoyed playing in the honky-tonk sound because it was unusual. I mean, there was nobody else doing it except for, you know, I'm sure there were some things on the West Coast, but there was nobody doing country music really except BR549 and me and Greg. That was it. I mean, in the way that we were doing it, you know, because we were very irreverent and we didn't, you know, we just played what we wanted, what we liked. And there's an enormous freedom to that, because if you're not doing any junk, you know, you're not doing anybody any favors, then you what you're playing really has meaning to you. And when it ceases to have meaning, then you just don't play it for a while. And a lot of artists don't have that luxury, you know. If they make a single, they got to go play that single, whether they hate it or not, yeah. Whether they got chipped out of the publishing or whatever it might be, they've got to go do it because there's somebody in the audience, you know, on their payroll who's waiting to hear it, you know, is watching them from afar. And so we never had that, you know. And I still see meet artists today who are clearly uncomfortable because a whole bunch of people have told them they've got to play something that they have no feeling for. So for me, I had, you know, being totally ignorant of the business, I just played what I wanted to play. So that was, you know, ignorance is bliss, right? I think as time went on, you know, once a drummer came into the group and I started playing more electric guitar, you know, things have actually become much more looser and noisier and less tidy. Well, I don't know if I've ever been tidy, but, you know, I think, as time goes on, I mean, the bands that I really love as far as the richness of them, I think of like Los Lobos and NRBQ and Doug Somm and, you know, and even some of the latter day Bob Dylan shows, you know, where it's Elvis Costello, you know, when they put on a show, it's a group of songs that have meaning to them, and whatever instruments they bring, that's how the songs are going to be colored. So it's you know, when a record comes out, I tend to sound like the record that we just made, you know, but I also really look forward to it changing, because once you get out of this, at least I'm sure it's like when you make a table or any kind of endeavor, once you get out of that state of mind, then, you know, you're able to let things breathe a little bit. And, you know, that's kind of one of the great joys of once you get a record done, is when you start performing it out a little bit, it starts to grow in ways that you know, you could never anticipate.
You mentioned a while back that your original goal was just to make records. Does that process of actually going into the studio still, like, get you jazzed up?
Oh, yeah. I love it. I love it, you know, and a lot of times it doesn't, I don't know how I'm going to do it again, you know, but I say that every after every record. Because yeah. It's like records can be really meaningful to people. And so when I don't have an idea, I can't imagine ever having an idea. And when I do have an idea, then it's totally overwhelmingly fun. You know, us musicians, you're a musician, all your listeners are, you get very sensitive to sounds. Thankfully, I'm not overly sensitive to sounds, but I'm always curious, like, why certain records sound the way they do. Like, we're in an era now where everything is very exaggerated. Like, bass drums are bass drums, and treble sounds are treble sounds, and everything is, like, really huge sounding, but it isn't always necessarily powerful. And so I'm always keen to, like, how do you make a record that sounds very atmospheric without exaggerate the instruments in a really interesting way. Like, I think it's Mike Persante who's engineered a lot of stuff for T-Bone Burnett. He's very good at getting a lot of interesting sounds. The Diana Krall record that came out a few years ago had some beautiful sounds on it. Raising Sand was a real unique record when it came out. It had enormous low end when bass was just actually not even heard in records, you know. But at the same time, if you listen to something from the 70s, you know, the bass is really audible and up front in a way that bass is not these days. Bass has become kind of, I don't know, it doesn't have the clarity that it does. Like, if you listen to even, say, anything, you know, reggae records and things from the early 70s, you know, we mentioned Lindsey Buckingham. If you listen to, I can't remember what the Fleetwood Mac record was before Rumors, but, you know, those two records, I think they're made back-to-back. Like, the bass is way up front, where you can almost tell what kind of a bass it is. I mean, it's really cool. And and records are not quite made that way, you know, and now. So, you know, when you're trying to do something different, sometimes the past is helpful, but other times it's, you know, it's just kind of a curiosity, like, you know, how did they get that sound? How can I do something that sounds different than what's going on? And it's not, you know, when one is a songwriter, you're sort of fated to write the kind of songs that you write. And so then the fun part in the studio is like, how do you trick yourself or trick the band into seeming like you're doing something different? So you're excited about it, but that, but you're also like at ease, you know? And that's one of the things that is very humbling. Or there's an aspect of early country music that's still very humbling, because the early songwriters like Floyd Tillman and Hank Williams, they were the first of their kind. You know, they were writing from personal experience and kind of merging what they thought of was like the way to write a song with how they felt. So they, you know, that's, they're kind of at the vanguard of being, doing something new, but also something that was understandable. So when Floyd Tillman writes a song like I Love You So Much It Hurts Me, it, you know, for, if you're in the mood to hear something like that, it cuts very deeply. And but at the same time, it's written in a way that's very, very acceptable for you to hear. You know, it's very easy and inviting, even though it's a very personal message. So, you know, it's a really handy thing to live in Nashville, because you're surrounded by really good songwriters, but you're also surrounded by people who are making really good records. And how to put those two things together is the trick.
Well, we should talk a little bit about your most recent record, the Jimmy Rogers Project. I know we did a whole article on it, and it's online and in the magazine, but can you kind of walk me through the process again of how that record came to be?
Well, if I haven't put your listeners to sleep yet.
No.
The way it was put together was over a long period of time, many years, I thought about writing from Jimmy's point of view, and eventually it developed into trying to put together instrumentation for each song, try to make each song kind of representative in a loose way of what he would have heard at the time. And there's and mostly I did that because it was a great excuse. It was a good excuse for the writing, but it was also, many of my fellow musicians like Dennis and Fats Kaplan, for instance, we're really fond of a lot of music from that time. Not only is it the beginning of artists like, you know, the careers of Duke Ellington and George Gershwin, but it's also a time when a lot of artists made maybe one or two records and then disappeared, but the records they made are really compelling. So depending on what the song was about, I tried to make the instrumentation fit that. There's a song called Ain't That Water Lucky, where Jimmy is sort of pondering whether to jump in the water or keep living. And for something like that, you know, I brought in some musicians from the Nashville Symphony and had cello and kind of had some a kind of dissonant thing happening. Mostly because I was thinking of songs like Old Man River and thinking of some of the early Gershwin things that are very striking of place and time. Whereas there's another song called the Gunter Hotel Blues, which is based on Jimmy keeping a room at a hotel in Texas where Robert Johnson ended up recording a few years later. And Jimmy would stay there. I think he had a radio show that he broadcast from there, but he also would hang around late and party with his admirers. and for something like that, you know, I tended to have more instruments like clarinet and you know, upright bass and drums and sort of a swinging sound that would be representative of what an early jazz band might sound like, you know, which a lot of them played hotel ballrooms and things like that. So it was really fun, because I had not really written for brass or string sections that much, or, you know, tried to make melodies with them in mind. And so it allowed, you know, gave me a chance to reach out to a lot of musicians I admired in town but hadn't ever played with before. So it was a lot of fun, and I knew a lot about Jimmy's life and had read about him over a long period of time, and the idea of writing from his point of view was, you know, it was a great challenge, but again, I also thought it was the most uncommercial thing that I could possibly do, which was kind of. You know, I wasn't really selling any records anyway, but to purposely not try to please people, but try to make something that's really an interesting piece of music and make a, you know, not please anyone in sort of a commercial way, you know, but just to say this is a story and this is a whole album and you know, listen to it as you would or read a book or a long short story. That was fun, you know, because, again, it was... there's things I'm sure that are similar, but there was nothing like it that I knew of, which is always helpful. You know, anytime you're doing or you're fooling yourself into thinking that you're doing something that you don't think there's anything quite like it, there's a lot of freedom to that. You know, and there's also, you know, you kind of put it through the mill because you want it to be good. There's nothing I could do to harm Jimmy, but I didn't want to do a bad job of it because Jimmy's music is so meaningful to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a project like that could go either way, and I for one think you hit a home run with it. I think you did a fantastic job of making it both
thank you.
Interesting,
it was fun,
and enjoyable.
It was fun, and it wasn't you know, it sounded like there's a lot of hand wringing, but it was very kind of just from the gut. It was really fun, you know, and not, you know, the song was recorded pretty live and to tape, and I just have a little studio in Nashville. It's nothing fancy, but I just have a 1-inch 8-track machine, and so the fidelity of it sounds really good. But 8-tracks, you know, you can't really it's not, you know, once you put bass guitar, drums, voice, piano, and strings or something else, you know, you're all done.
Yeah.
And you're all filled up, so it was that kept it from being too baroque.
Your records have always had this, you know, beautiful arc, if not concept, behind some of them at least. Do you have ideas for what's next?
I do. I can't really put it into words. The only clue I can give you is that my son and I have been listening over the last year or more constantly to a great record by the Beastie Boys called Paul's Boutique,
of course,
which we're especially fond of. We listen to a lot of newer stuff too, but I've wanted for a long time to try to get out of something that sounds so centrically American. But you know, obviously this is my country and this is where I am, and happy to be so. But I thought that I probably would like to take a break from making something that seems so, you know, definitely that has such an American personality. And I mentioned Los Lobos again because I think that they, you know, they are very good, especially sonically, of putting their records in a different place where you recognize them as the band we've always loved, but you think of them. Well, I hear them and I could think, well, you could hear this at a discotheque in France, or you could hear it anywhere really, because the beat might be American, but the way it's recorded, sounds very interesting. It sounds very international, but that's as far as I've gotten so far.
All right. You're the Mark Ribot chapter of your life, or
perhaps.
All right. Thanks so much, Paul.
Listen, thank you very much, and I really appreciate your time.
Of course. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye.